Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite intercontinental football podcast. We are in the thick of the World Cup. Two rounds of group games done and one to go. We're going to do something slightly different today. Obviously, we did kind of reviewing the first round of games in our episode last week. What we're going to do today is talk a little bit about some of the rises and fallers in terms of stock from those second round, but it all comes up so fast now. Six games a day for the next few days means that effectively these are going to change so quickly. We thought we'd do something that has a little bit more of a shelf life. So we're going to talk about some players who might have stood out, what their transfer situations might be, and whether there might be some interest in those players across the course of the summer, combining the World Cup with some of the bits and bobs that Mr. Dean Jones knows. My name is Jack Collins, and I am joined by Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. I'm hot. Most people know, but I'm over in England at the moment suffering through this heat wave that's ongoing, which is almost 100 degrees Fahrenheit today. It's ridiculous, isn't it? Like, it's absolutely ludicrous. Like, get me back to the bearable heat of San Diego, mate. Like,
this is the thing, right? Like, it's just it's the infrastructure. I know this is like a ridiculous thing to say, but like, it's just not built for heat, the UK. And you know, I'm going to Miami in about a week and a half's time. It's definitely going to be hotter in Miami. Like, I have no doubt about that whatsoever. But I also know that that city is built to deal with the heat and that there will be air conditioning in buildings and that it's not going to be just completely unbearable all of the time. And I can't wait. I'm the first person going to Miami in the middle of the summer to get a bit cooler, I think.
Yeah, it actually is hotter here at the moment than Miami, mate, by about 10 degrees Fahrenheit. But I take your point. The humidity is obviously going to be as insane. And that's the thing that kills me, humidity. We don't have that in San Diego. But yeah, obviously, today, I was going around town here where we live. And like, where can I go that's got aircon? Like, tried Costa? No. Tried another coffee shop? No. Fortunately, there's like a Sainsbury's that's got a Starbucks attached to it, and it was lovely. And then after about an hour or so, I was like, I'm cold, I need a blanket. But yeah, finding aircon is not easy. Apart from that, mate, obviously I'm still not happy with the kickoff times being over here. It doesn't suit anybody who's a bit older and has kids. And I totally understand everyone over in England that is struggling to feel part of this World Cup, not just in England, like parts of Europe, wherever else in the world, where it's not on a convenient time zone. And so we've obviously talked about this before, but it does remain the case. And obviously I've had a lot going on this week, which I'll talk about separately over on the Patreon. Please do come over there. And it just hasn't fit, mate. Like, I'm struggling. Like, with the jet lag, a 1 a.m. kickoff's fine. A 3 a.m. kickoff, actually, a couple of them were okay. Not the fives. But now I'm into more of a regular pattern. Anything past midnight and I'm struggling.
I mean, I've settled into a rhythm. And again, like, I think it's wild to complain about kickoff times and all of these things because it should suit the nation it's in. And actually, I had a couple of messages about this from our patrons and from listeners to the podcast who were like, yeah, but actually it's quite annoying because the World Cup's in the States and the latter stages are actually geared towards European times a bit more. And like, we're going to be in the middle of our work days when the round of the 16 and the quarterfinals are going on. Now, like, it's not actually particularly convenient for us either. Mm. And I was like, yeah, it's a really good point and that's one that I hadn't really considered.
But you do have that anyway, you know, like I've talked before about, I remember, have school memories of like jumping out of the window when England scored against whoever it was at one of the World Cups, and Colombia, I think it was. Because, you know, the games were going on in the middle of the day, and like, I remember France 98, like, it was like just not convenient and stuff like that. Euro 96, and that was kind of the fun, though. And like, obviously, you know, if you're young enough and you can get away with a day off school, you go ahead with it. Work's a bit more difficult, obviously.
Second screen business, right?
But yeah, that's at least it's more sociable than being on at 3 a.m. I can tell you that much.
This is the thing. Like, I never really thought, obviously we work in the game, like, but I never really thought about it with Qatar, but there was loads of games that kicked off at 11 a.m., which are great for me, but I imagine not great for people who are just running 9-to-5s, right? Like, yeah, that's probably not ideal. So yeah, it happens every time. It's going to happen. You know, next World Cup is obviously over 6 different countries. We're going to have the South American start and then moving over to Morocco and Spain and Portugal, which will be more convenient for Europe and less convenient for the States. And, you know, another one that doesn't necessarily sit within the Australian time frame, the New Zealand time frame, Japanese time frame. There's plenty of, you know, this happens every time. And I suppose maybe we're just seeing more moaning about it because social media is more like that these days. We've dealt with it before. We'll deal with it again. I like my rhythm though. I've got like, I watch the games up to about a 2 a.m. kickoff. Like, anything that starts before 2 a.m. I'll watch that night. And yeah, if there's 2 a.m.s or 5 a.m.s or 3 a.m.s, they're the ones I record for the next morning. I wake up and it's the first thing I do is I watch those ones. So yeah, I mean, like, it's working. I found my rhythm, which is something. And look, it takes us on to part one of this podcast where we are going to talk about rise and fallers. Last week, we talked about teams with questions to answer. We talked about the teams that had impressed us. So let's talk a little bit about what happened in the second round and where it leads teams going forward. Because I think that that's the interesting part of this. I have England top of the, not top, but like bottom of the falling rankings. They are in there because they did so well in that first game. And then the second game, I think, was a kind of story of, okay, how is it you stop this team with such incredible attacking threat? Well, you set up like Ghana do. The reason England are not higher in this, I think, is because it feels a little bit Spain-Portugal-y in reverse. And I also don't know how many times England are going to come up against this again. Like a team that will literally just sit in front of them. The reason they remain in it rather than just being out of this altogether is because I think that Ghana did show that if you sit in and you counter at pace, there are ways you can get at this England defense. And I think that there were multiple occasions yesterday where players looked very, very kind of uncomfortable with the way that that fast break was working. And obviously we see it with the moment that leads to the Jordan Pickford challenge outside the box. I don't think necessarily the refs 100% got that one wrong because the challenge from Prince Adu is a little bit high and therefore the referee's given a free kick. But I think that the Ezri Konsa challenge is pretty much a stonewall penalty. And I'm very, very surprised that wasn't referred to by VAR. And that does potentially show a few gaps and cracks in that back line.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it was hugely disappointing. You know, Thomas Tuchel, always been up in the air about, I don't know how I feel about it. And I'm fine. Like, if we play the way we played against Croatia, then I'm more than happy to see him take us to new levels. But if I wanted to see more of what Gareth Southgate was doing, then he could have stayed. And that's what I saw against Ghana from both perspectives, really. Like, we're always going to be a little bit vulnerable because, and again, I do blame Tuchel partly for that because I think that there are squad choices he could have made that would have made us better. Maguire, I think, is a 50-50 call. Lewis Hall, I think, is a much stronger case than that to have been there. But yeah, we've shown that we are susceptible and thankfully Ghana and Prince just weren't capable of making the most of opportunities that came because we could easily, to be honest, we should have fallen behind. And in a way, I wanted us to. In a way, I was like, just do it. Just do it and see what we've got about us. In the end, it just turned into a turgid draw that is just frustrating. I mean, The most annoying thing really about it is when I was predicting how this tournament would go for England, I was like, we'll draw with Croatia, we'll beat Ghana 1-0, and then we'll beat Panama 3-0 or 4-0, and then that'll be that. And it'll be very uneventful, and everyone will be like, yeah, more of the same. But because we did what we did to Croatia, I was more hopeful about Ghana. My prediction at kickoff was 5-0. 5-0.
I mean, credit to Ghana because I watched that first game against Panama and they were absolutely all over the place. Carlos Queiroz, the old master, I think it's what, 5 World Cups in a row, maybe 6 now that he's managed at, has in a week really kind of changed the dynamic. And I think, look, part of that is potentially just playing against the ball rather than being expected to dominate the game.
I mean, it was boring. I'm not going to lie. I didn't like the way what they did to us. Like, it was
Yeah, but
it was like, a boring game because of what they, you know.
That's how you have to play against a team that is of superior quality to you.
That's why we might get better in the knockouts, just because you're playing against teams who also have expectations and have to come out and do something a bit more than that.
Yeah, 100%. And look, I think England will win the next game and I think they will win the group and therefore it's kind of no harm done.
Yeah, but we definitely have slid in terms of expectations. And obviously at the end of the last pod, I said we're going to win it. Still might. I'm not saying we don't win it now just because of that. I've even got an England shirt, mate. My kids got me an England shirt for Father's Day.
There you go.
I got the red England shirt. So I'm fully on. And I said, well, how come you got me an England? Taylor said, well, I've never actually heard you say that England were going to win anything. She goes, I even remember going to the final not expecting to win. She goes, but you actually said, she goes, I listened to your podcast the other day and you said England are going to win it. And I was like, then the kids are going to get you an England shirt, because if you're that optimistic, then this is the shirt you're going to need.
Should have waited a week.
You should have waited a week, could have saved yourself 90 quid.
I was thinking exactly the same. Alas, we are. Again, I don't think it's going to necessarily affect where England go. I think that we'll be in that top spot. And I think that they might well still make a deep run. But I think there were some cracks that were at the very least kind of dimmed the optimism from everyone that I've spoken to in the last.
Those wide players as well, man. Like, I can't go without that. Like, Gordon and Madueke drove me insane. They drove me mad. And I hope Saka's ready, man. I want to see him unleashed properly now.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, let's go quickly to the other two that I've got in here. At two, I have Uruguay. The reason they're not top is because my expectations for Uruguay weren't that high, but equally, I still thought that they would probably come second in this group. And now I think that they will not come second in this group. Now, look, shouts out to Cap Verde, who put together another very, very impressive performance against them. And now we'll go into that final game against Saudi Arabia, believing fundamentally that they can win that game and go through here. So they deserve immense credit. We spoke about them obviously a little bit last week. We spoke about them on the Patreon as well. They're an incredible story. They're an incredibly well put together unit and they play some really, really fun football as well. But Uruguay, I think from the point where you go 2-1 up in this game, there's not many people expecting Uruguay to go and drop it from there, right? And there have been some standout performers who we'll talk about a little bit later. But this, I think, was chaotic and ultimately not what you're expecting from a side under Marcelo Bielsa. I thought that they lacked a real intensity, which is kind of the hallmark of a Bielsa side. They're really lacking X factor in the final third to try and make things happen. And it does just feel like they're very, very one-dimensional. Now, look, that's a kind of point that I will make about the team who are number one in this as well. But I think that Uruguay would have come into this with a little bit of trepidation, considering that the end of a kind of boom bust Bielsa cycle. But equally, they would have still felt that they would have been comfortable getting out of this group. And now, you know, not just in terms of, you know, them sitting there on 2 points, but also they have to go and get something off Spain if they are going to qualify. They probably have to beat Spain, you know, if they're going to get through here. That is a very, very big ask. And I think when you're kind of looking at where they have been and the performances they've put in so far at this World Cup, there's not much to suggest that they're going to be able to go and do that.
No, not at all. We knew that they would be a weird team, and half the fun of watching Uruguay is you don't know what you're going to get, and it'll be partly brilliant, it'll be partly rubbish. And that's exactly what we've got. Bielsa is going to take some serious stick if they are eliminated at this stage, which they probably are going to be.
Bielsa's going to go after this World Cup, whatever happens. But like,
it's like the thing is, and you won't like this, and Sam won't like this, is people are going to go after him because it's already started. If you know, you only have to be on social media for 10 minutes before you start getting to some takes that are being like, what's Bielsa actually done? That we're at that stage. I've seen it. I've listened to it this week, and I've seen, you know, fans of a couple of clubs he's been at hitting back at it. But from a broader perspective, you know, people are starting to be like, yeah, this bloke was never really that good. He was just a bit quirky, and he's going to have to answer that in a very strong way by going and getting a result against Spain. Maybe he's capable of it, but the way that they failed to win this latest game was a bit ridiculous. Like, seeing them turn it around, I actually turned the game off mainly because it was late. But once they'd gone ahead in that game, I was like, ah, oh, that's a shame, because it was a good battle. but they're going to get that done. I woke up the next morning and see they didn't win, and I was like, oh my God, how have they managed that? So, yes, chaotic. Yes, disappointing. But no, not unexpected that this has actually happened to this team.
Yeah, I mean, look, to a degree, and look, people are always going to make arguments about Bielsa. I think his kind of empowerment and the way that his managerial tree has expanded into other people is as influential as almost anyone on the planet. And look, when you look at the clubs that he's taken to different places and nations as well, it's not like he's gone out and managed top sides in their respective teams. You know, apart from Argentina for that 6-year spell from sort of 98 to 2004, there's not loads of clubs here you'd be like, oh yeah, they should be in and around winning the league. Now, obviously he had, you know, a great time at Newell's Old Boys where he won two titles with them. And then, you know, he went to Atlas in America, in Mexico. He came back to Vélez where he did well as well. But then you're like Espanyol, the Argentina spell, Chile, who he took further than they might have even imagined. They're, you know, they have the kind of fan group, which are known as Daughters of Bielsa, right? Like that's the influence that he had on Chilean football. And look where they are now in the kind of post-Bielsa era. He did well with Athletic. He got to two finals. Marseille, he lasted, what, approximately a year? It was a bit of a mucky spell at that point. He did brilliantly with Leeds. And then you kind of come to it and you think, well, this Uruguay spell hasn't been particularly... I would say that there's not been loads to suggest that he should have won loads more things across the course of it. But I would say his influence stretches beyond, you know, silverware from a managerial standpoint. But look, people are going to look at that in different ways.
No,
he's never,
no,
he's never going to be put in the conversation of Ancelotti and Guardiola, right? But I think he should be in the conversation of someone like a Juan Malillo or a, you know, that kind of coaches who went out there and changed the way that people thought about the game as much as anything else. And Bielsa's influence remains very, very high. I mean, let's go to number one here, which is Belgium under Rudy Garcia. Another disappointing result for them. This could have been worse if Varane's free kick in the first half had been onside, and there was no reason for Mehdi Taremi to be offside there, I've got to say. But Belgium just completely flattering to deceive. And again, look, they're coming off the edge of what was a golden generation, inverted commas. You know, they have lost a few of those sparks. The players who have replaced, you know, those absolute world beaters, you know, Eden Hazard to Leandro Trossard, as much as I love Trossard, is a downgrade, right? Like wearing that number 10 shirt, you're looking at it and thinking, where's the X factor in this Belgium team? And I think we are seeing that there fundamentally isn't any. Now, I expect them to get out of the group. They have obviously a game against New Zealand to finish this off, and a point will probably get them through. But equally, you're looking at it and saying the first side that Belgium come up against who are able to take their chances are almost certainly going to be able to rip this side apart. There is absolutely no X factor in this team.
I'm so bored of this team, mate. It's like watching a charity game every time they play. It's like you could put together a Soccer Aid 11 and they would beat Belgium. Like, they are so boring, mate. I can't handle it. I actually cannot handle watching this team, and I cannot imagine what the Belgian nation is making of watching this. Like, on paper, they are still all right, but like, it's just gone, isn't it? Like, everything that could have been has been and gone. It's like that moment when the Tielemans like did an air kick and Dylan was literally rolling on the floor laughing, and he was like, "Dad, you can't play at a World Cup and do that." I was like, well, it's a bit of bad luck. But yeah, I take your point. That moment did kind of sum up what Belgium have become.
I mean, look, he's the captain as well. And it feels like Youri Tielemans, in the last 20 minutes of games, just remembers that he's the captain of his nation. He's like, oh, I probably should start playing. It's really odd. Really odd. And they are in transition. And there are kind of caveats to this.
He hasn't played that badly, you know, like for a club. Like, it's not like I would have anticipated him to be off key. Obviously, they've got unlucky with the red card, I guess. I did feel sorry for him on the red card in this latest game against Iran, but it was almost an excuse in the end. The fact that they were down to 10 men was like an excuse for the performance being okay to come out of a draw. I'm not exaggerating. Like, it genuinely, they are the team I've least enjoyed watching, I think, at the World Cup, like, because of expectations compared to what you're actually seeing.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, the answer to that is Tunisia, but at least the opposition score. So at the very least, it's
exactly. I watched two. Was it 1-1 the first game? Yeah, 1-1, right? The first game.
Yeah.
Like, it's just rubbish, mate. It's just almost unwatchable. And I just hate watching this team. I can't handle it.
I imagine Soccer the Belgian press took a look at this group and thought, okay, we might not be as good as we once were, but we should be okay here.
I hope New Zealand beat them. I really do.
Why? Like, it's almost like put it out of the misery. I feel like a wounded animal in so
put
many ways.
Put this golden generation to bed once and for all.
Yeah, no, I think that might very much be the case. And Belgium can then start to move on because there is a young, talented back line, I think, starting to emerge. There are some interesting players here. But yeah, it's just not working. They feel like they're using this as a farewell tour, and I don't particularly like it. All right, let's flip it quickly to Rising. I mean, I think you could put 3 and 2 here in the same category in Spain and Portugal. Both had major questions to answer in different ways. I had Portugal ahead of them, so I have Portugal ahead of them here in the Rising category. But there's one thing that links both of these performances. Both of them beat, you know, inferior opposition in their second game. Spain in Saudi Arabia and Portugal in Uzbekistan. Both had drawn their opening encounters, Portugal to DR Congo and Spain to Cap Verde. But the intensity, the difference in intensity and the managerial tweaks to sort things out here, I think both deserve major credit because the way that both of them attacked these two games was like, hang on, you thought we were done. And I think there's plenty of similarities in terms of the way that both these teams want to control games in the midfield. Both of them have absolutely unbelievable quality in that middle area. But they felt like they'd left both of their strikers in different ways very, very isolated in their opening games. We spoke about the fact that Oyarzabal touched the ball didn't touch the ball in the first 31 minutes of the game against Cap Verde. And there were serious question marks about how you get the best out of Cristiano Ronaldo with the team as it was. And I thought that both De La Fuente and Roberto Martinez did very well to get bodies in and around their strikers. De La Fuente moved Pedri backwards, put Olmo in there, and he effectively played off the shoulder, which gave Oyarzabal more spaces to run into, and they found him more regularly. It helps when Lamine Yamal comes back into the team, plays for 45 minutes, and effectively drags three players to him in every sense. But for Portugal, I thought he was even smarter because João Félix started on the left-hand side and effectively just drifted into the middle. We know that he's had that combination with Cristiano over the course of the season in the SPL. And on the other side, Pedro Neto switches over and he's driving inwards. It meant both of the fullbacks got really high. It meant that there were bodies in the box. When Cristiano scores his first goal, there are five Portugal players in the Uzbekistan box. And look, both of their opponents here tried to play out a little bit more than they did in their opponents in the first games. But equally, you still can only beat what's in front of you to answer some questions. And I thought that the little tweaks that both of them did in order to kind of sort things out, we talked about having players around Cristiano, right? But getting bodies into the box. So if you are going to swing the ball in there, it's not one man isolated against three centre-backs. And suddenly, you've got a very different game. Suddenly you have Bruno bursting through the middle of the pitch. Suddenly Cancelo is really high on one side and Nuno Mendes is really high on the other side. And then you have a team that looks like it is functioning as a whole. And I thought both of these sides in Spain and Portugal both looked far more like cohesive units in their second games after having questions to answer in their first.
Yeah, it's tough to read because, you know, you could compare it. England have had the opposite of this, you know, got off to a flyer in terms of intensity and performance levels and then dropped off. And these two have done it the other way round and they've only beaten Uzbekistan and Saudi Arabia. There's nothing to write home about yet. But because it happens in the second game, you've got momentum going into your last group game and into the knockouts, whereas England had the opposite. So that's why they sit, you know, falling rather than rising. So difficult to judge what it actually means. And, you know, Spain beating a team ranked 61 in the world 4-0, like, yeah, tell me something I didn't know. Portugal felt a bit different just because it did get Ronaldo in the groove. It kind of gave the World Cup a bit of an edge. You know, obviously, like, after what Messi's been doing, Ronaldo needed to retaliate from a personal perspective. And he did. And the World Cup did need that. Like, as much as I don't actually care whether Ronaldo scores goals or not at this World Cup, like, once he did it, I was like, oh, this is actually more fun. It is more fun if we get Ronaldo into the knockouts and see him either fluff his lines or score a really big goal.
There was a sense of relief about it, I think, right? Like, as in, I was like, oh, at least that's done. Like, at least you're not going to have this for 4 weeks. Like, and look, it doesn't mean the questions go away. They will continue in these final games. And actually, their pathway has been weirdly similar, Spain and Portugal, in that they start against a hard-to-break-down African nation. Then they play, you know, a nation from the Middle East in their second game, and they play very well. And then they're both against South American nations in their final game, which should, on paper, be harder tests. Colombia more so for Portugal than Europe. Uruguay for Spain on the evidence of what we've seen so far. But I think it is interesting the parallels between the two, considering that, you know, they are neighbors and there is always going to be that kind of rivalry between the two nations. It kind of gives it a different edge. So I'm excited to see how it kind of shakes onwards. But
yeah, look, I mean, it's good recovery. It's good recovery.
Exactly, exactly. And it just gets you into the mood. And I think it would have been disingenuous to not talk about Portugal in the same way as talking about Spain. And some people have tried to kind of do that and be like, yeah, but it was Uzbekistan. I'm like, yes, but Spain's played Saudi Arabia, who I thought were going to be dreadful at this World Cup. And both of them were poor, right? No doubt about that. But at least it gets them into a more of a rhythm of what we expect to see later in this tournament. And perhaps it is the catalyst for both of them to go on and improve. I mean, top of this list, though, Dean, I had the Netherlands, who are a side that I really wasn't convinced by coming into this. I really wasn't sure about Ronald Koeman and what he was going to do, but credit to him, he brings in Brian Brobby for this game, and suddenly it looks like they're occupying centre-backs. Suddenly both wingers get on the score sheet, Cody Hakpo from one side and Crescencio Somerville from the other after he replaced Daniel Marlin at halftime. 2-2 for Somerville, who I imagine is going to start from this point out. And the Netherlands looked really impressive. There are still concerns. Like, I still don't think that out of possession, they look particularly secure in the midfield areas. And I think that there are gaps in behind both the fullbacks, which can be exploited by teams who will move quickly in transition. But I don't think that people saying, oh, but Sweden had loads of opportunities is testament to what the Netherlands did here, because the game state shook out, right? And actually, they were 2-0 up. They looked comfortable. They allowed Sweden onto them. You know, they would have got a bit of a rollicking at halftime, I imagine. Came out, put the game to bed. And yeah, okay, Sweden do well in the last 15, 20 minutes of both halves. But this was a really impressive performance from the Netherlands. And I thought that they looked very sharp. And suddenly that looks like an attacking line that's going to give problems to almost anybody.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, they do deserve to be the big risers because they were interesting, to be honest. They won and it was interesting. And they put to bed the narrative that I thought was going to build was that they're not actually that good. Sweden has had such a big win first off, were buoyant on the back of that. They've obviously got a great attacking threat of their own in Isak and Jokeres. And I thought that might be the storyline that ended up coming out the second game. But, you know, that 5-3-2 that Sweden was starting to test and they thought that was a success has now been absolutely demolished. And the Netherlands have kind of made a big statement there. And I think, yeah, the biggest statement of their second group of games that we've seen.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. All righty, we're going to take a little break there. When we come back on the other side, we're going to talk a little bit about the USMNT and then some big players who could be making big moves this summer. Stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where we're going to turn our attention a little bit to the US men's national team, because two wins from two have won the group, and that last game against Turquia, which a lot of people had a few nerves about, is now a dead rubber for both sides, with Turquia out of the competition. I mean, look, we've been very impressed with the US team. Their intensity's been absolutely incredible. They have been one of the sides that have stood up and been the most impressive in this World Cup so far. We've kind of done that to death to a degree, right? So going to go into it, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how Pochettino goes about his business in this last game. Do they go for momentum? Do they rest the players on yellow cards? Does Pulisic get 20 minutes and no more? How will they deal with that? That's a headache for Pochettino, but a headache he would have killed to have at the start of the tournament. So I'm not sure that this game against Turquia matters all that much. But I do think it's interesting that there is a few players in this US side who are being touted with potential moves this summer. Flo Balogun kind of leading that pack, but I think that there will be interest in someone like an Alex Freeman, who obviously moved to Villarreal, but seems to have all the qualities to potentially play in a more physically dominant league as well. And even Christian Pulisic, who is at Milan, but there is a lot of things up in the air at Milan. And I wonder if a good kind of World Cup here might increase his stock and increase his desirability to some of the other nations and the other leagues around Europe in particular. There's plenty to think about, but I think that those three are the headline names.
Yeah, I mean, the stock is riding for all three. I mean, Freeman, obviously a bit more of an unknown quantity in a global context, but he's making a big case for himself in that team. Balogun and Pulisic are the headline act. There is no need to play Pulisic, but even just on what we saw, he did set the tone for what they've done since. And even when he's sidelined, they're still striving to make sure that they are capable of doing what he was doing when he was on the pitch in the first half of the first game, because that's where they set the tone and set the standard of their tournament that has now had articles written about, could USMNT actually win the World Cup? And that's fine. Like, I want the host nation to be talking like that. Like, it's fine to be having that debate. You want to build excitement and hype. They're not going to do that, no.
The only reason I'm a little bit wary of that conversation, and look, I'm all for everyone getting excited, right? Like, and everyone being like, yeah, let's go and win it. That's great stuff. Is that the, you know, does the expectation change how you perceive the World Cup? Like I said before the tournament, that quarterfinal would be a very, very impressive thing for the US to get to. That looks like a, you know, I said the round of 16 was par. Anything above that is better than par. Anything below that is worse. Now they're going to get to the round of 32. They look like they're going to get a favorable draw in the fact that they've won their group. Now it's a question of kind of, can they step on it in the knockout stages? So far, we have nothing to suggest that they don't. I just worry that some of the conversations about winning it and all of these elements might just change the angle of how it's perceived. And that's the only thing that really worries me a little bit. Expectations suddenly change the angle of, you know, what people see as success.
Yeah, I mean, a quarterfinal is still beyond good, but, and it's not a bad thing if that starts to feel like disappointment, because that should still be a disappointment for a first 11 version of this team at a home World Cup, because they are good. But once you get to that stage, you're going to be digging deeper in. You're going to be perhaps facing a suspension, or you have a Pulisic injury or somebody like that. And that's where you've got to reset your expectations. But yeah, in terms of Balogun and Pulisic, you know, Balogun is going to be leaving Monaco. We don't know where he's going to land yet, but it's probably going to be a club in the Premier League. It's going to take over £40 million to sign him. So almost $60 million for the US fans out there who are wondering where their boy is going to land and what team they're going to be buying a jersey with his name on for next season. He's looked good, mate. He has, you know, he's certainly given this team something they feared they were going to be missing, and they've got it. And in fact, they've got a few options up there, because they've got the backup options. They just didn't know if they had the main man, and they have got a main man in Balogun. And the fact he's got a bit of confidence also is very handy. So I think Balogun gets a transfer at that sort of price range, actually, no problem. And Pulisic is a bit of a wild card option. Obviously at AC Milan, he's got a new manager. Ruben Amorim has got the job there. We'll see. What does his personality fit with Ruben Amorim? I don't know. Pulisic was actually linked with Man United not that far in the past, but never ended up being a United player, and so Amorim hasn't dealt with him in that sense. But it's a tough one. I actually want to see Pulisic stay at AC Milan, because I want him to be a success at AC Milan and for that to fully be considered, like, because, you know, I think he's done fine there, but obviously it's been in fits and starts. And I just want this to continue.
Does he need a manager who's going to play with wingers? Now, I know he's playing as a nominal 10 here, you know, in that kind of system. But equally, I do think that his kind of strength is drifting out to that left-hand side, attacking from, you know, kind of the wide areas into the corner of the box. It was one of the reasons that last year was such a struggle, was because Allegri continued to play him, you know, through the middle of the park. I do wonder if Amorim's system might just nullify him a little bit if he's not given that ability to combine with his wing back and get into those spaces. Equally, you know, if they build it, he does look like a player that could effectively continue to be a key part of this Milan side.
Yeah. Look, he got 8 goals and 6 assists last season, and he'll want double figures on both of those next season. And when you see the way he played in that opening World Cup game, it's a player that can definitely do that. It wouldn't surprise me if somebody does come in for him this summer, but let's see what Pulisic's capable of. Obviously, he is on his return now to full fitness. I doubt we'll see much, if any, of him in this third game because there's no need. Maybe he gets a 20-minute or so cameo just to give a run out.
Minutes
to the
in the legs,
toes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But his stock is rising still, despite the fact it all came like almost 2 weeks ago.
I'm intrigued by what happens with Alex Freeman. You know, obviously he made that move in January to Villarreal. Since then, it's sort of been a little bit in and out. He struggled to get minutes right at the start. He gave 3 starts kind of in 4 games just as we got into sort of April, May. And then he ended the campaign back on the bench. I think his stock has gone up in this World Cup, that ability to sort of tuck inside, but also to stretch and be that kind of athletic figure. I'd imagine there are clubs looking at him, especially because the fee to Villarreal wasn't too high, that they might actually look at him and be like, oh, you know what, if we can flip a quick profit on that, then that is something that we might be interested in doing. But I'm quite intrigued because I think he has all the physical capabilities to be a very, very good right back in a Premier League capacity.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, obviously at the Athletic, I work closely with the guys that cover that team, and he's grown on them massively for that role. I remember when it was first mooted, there was a bit of skepticism about it, but I think we're in a good spot now with that one.
Yeah, 100%. All righty, should we flip onwards from the US and go to a couple of players who made a big move last week? We talked about 2 of these as being standout players, but there are movements in the market on 2 of them. So let's start with Ayub Bouwadi, Dean. He obviously had an incredible first game against Brazil. He was very good against Scotland as well. He is someone who I thought might be on for a big move next summer, but this World Cup has effectively just transported him to, okay, someone's going to have to do this summer because he's not going to be on the market next summer if you wait for him. What are you hearing? What are you thinking about Ayub Bouwadi?
Mate, talk about a World Cup platform, making sure that you are well primed for a big move. I mean, he was in the minds of big clubs anyway, but like now you are literally looking at Arsenal, Liverpool, PSG, Real Madrid in the frame to try and sign this lad from Lille. And obviously Lille more than happy that if he is going to leave them, that this is the stage on which it's happening, because they're going to get top dollar for him and make sure that they get a fee, which, you know, those clubs I've mentioned were hoping it would be close or maybe no more than £50 million. And now you're looking at it getting to £60 million upwards because of the type of competition you're going to face to sign him. 18 years old, to show the confidence, the composure that he's managing to show, whatever stage he's on, whether it's a domestic game or now an international game, just goes to show that he's just completely unfazed by anything you put in front of him. Obviously, there'll be the feeling that maybe he should stay in France for now, because leaving French football is a much bigger step. Joining PSG is obviously not easy because of the type of competition he's got to even get onto the pitch in the first place. But at least the transition into the team, once he's in it, is easier than going to those other 3 that I've mentioned if they were to be his landing spot. But yeah, I mean, there's always somebody, mate, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, he's not the same type of player as James Rodriguez, but you know, it's like there's always that player, that moment. And his moment came in that first game with just an unbelievable first performance that captured everyone's attention. And as soon as people started to Google him, they would have realized that, oh, he's been doing this for a while now.
Yeah, he made his Lille debut, I think, a couple of days before his 16th birthday. So this isn't necessarily new. His switch to Morocco from being French under 21's captain was relatively big news in that part of the world, but probably didn't necessarily scratch the surface, across the globe, if you will. I think that his name is now being bandied around amongst those big clubs. I did feel like he feels like a Real Madrid player, but I thought they would probably wait a year. And now I wonder if they just go, right, we're going to plug the gap in midfield, especially, you know, is Tchouaméni going to be there next season? Is Camavinga going to be there next season? We don't know the answer to these questions. But I think that there feels like a restructuring going on at Real Madrid already. There's already kind of names through the door who have kind of signed and looked to be this next phase. I wonder if they do look at this, look at the fact that there hasn't been, you know, a midfield replacement that stepped up particularly to the plate, bar Tchouaméni, and his situation's a little bit different, obviously, with that fight with Valverde. You know, if they go, right, this is where we're going to kind of hang our hat. Equally, they were burned before on Camavinga, and he hasn't quite lived up to the expectations that they thought he might. That doesn't mean he's a bad player. I think someone's going to get a steal on Camavinga for what it's worth. I think he's a wonderful footballer, but it hasn't worked for Real Madrid in the way that they would have wanted. And I wonder if this is the gamble that they go and take here. It also, weirdly, feels like the one of these teams where he goes and he kind of walks straight into the side. You know, is he going to go and start for an Arsenal team? This isn't to say he shouldn't, but like, is he going to go and break up an Arsenal midfield that has just won the league and made the Champions League final? Probably not. Is he going to walk into a PSG midfield that's won back-to-back Champions Leagues? Probably not. Real Madrid feels odd in that it feels like that's the option that actually guarantees you probably the most first team football.
Yeah, that is a weird one for sure. Either way, he can't really lose from here. He has got to be careful because that Real Madrid move, you know, it might make you salivate a little bit, but who knows what happens next season at Real Madrid? Like, it might be great, it might not. And if things aren't going well and you're caught up in that, then very quickly it can affect you in every sense that a footballer can be. So that'll be a tough choice. But as I say, like, there are definitely worse dilemmas to face in life.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to see how his career progresses. Could be one of the big, big stars launching off this World Cup. Let's go to someone a little bit more well-known already in Canada's Jonathan David. Obviously scores a hat-trick in the game against Qatar and joins Lionel Messi in that little club from this World Cup thus far. But also someone who made the move, the free agent move from Lille to Juventus. There was a lot of excitement. It has not gone as Jonathan David would have wanted it to. They've signed a bunch of other strikers to compete in those zones. And it feels like he might be someone who's kind of phased out of this next element of where Juve are going. If they do, I think that there will be a little bit of a clamor for his signature because he's not only proved that he can do it, you know, at Lille, and in that time he scored a lot of goals. He's a very fun player in that he can facilitate, he can drop a little bit deeper, he can play as the nine, but also off the back of this World Cup where this Canada side looked to him as their talisman.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what he'll want to happen is that this proves to Juve that he could be the answer still, right? He's wanted that move to work out, but ultimately he's got a lot of people that are skeptical about him, and I am one of those people. I mean, I remember it was not that long ago when West Ham were looking at signing him, and there was somebody at the club who was just like, I don't think he'll score 3 Premier League goals. Like, people are very, it's like Marmite really with Jonathan David. Some people absolutely rave about him and believe that like he could get 20 goals in the Premier League. And some people look at him and don't think he can get 5. So, and I see that in his performances. I see every time I understand both sides of that argument. And I genuinely don't know what would happen if he, say, ended up joining Tottenham, for example. I'm glad he's having a moment here. And I hope it's good for his confidence, because clearly, as a striker, a confidence position, it can elevate you very quickly. And this could be an exciting one, because we have been waiting for him to bang again somewhere else for a little while now.
Yeah, I mean, look, it did feel like Juve wanted to kind of part ways with him before then. He's basically said he wants to stay and he wants to fight for his place. Obviously, they have a Pender there as well. If both of them stay and they don't have Champions League football, I find it very difficult to believe that Juve will have the capacity financially, at the very minimum, to be able to go and sign another top-level striker. And that gives them food for thought. But equally, this will, and at the very least, put a couple of people on notice that if he wanted to move away, that there might be something to kind of dig into there. And bear in mind that any fee whatsoever would be profit for Juventus because they signed him on that free transfer. I mean, We left him to last here. We talked about him last week. Yandy Amande, an incredible first performance that really did kind of set the world on notice against Ecuador. I thought that he was a bit more hot and cold in his preferred left-hand side position against Germany, although he was still absolutely crucial in the Cote d'Ivoire goal. It does feel like someone is going to try and make this gamble. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk about Liverpool. There's been a lot of talk about bids. They've also bought Victor Munoz, who's part of the Spain squad from Osasuna. They're clearly trying to kind of restock those wide options. Does that feel still like the most likely landing spot for him, Dean?
I mean, they're definitely still trying to go for this. I mean, they've kind of had Bradley Barcola in the background as one that they've been trying to look at. But Diamande is one that Liverpool are desperate for. Obviously, €100 million not proving enough so far to get him out of Leipzig. I mean, you don't usually see trajectories that are quite as rapid as this. I mean, you talk about the role that he'll play. I think they got Liverpool in for the right. I don't think they want him for the left.
Well, based on the two performances, you'd think that that might work.
Yeah, and so obviously with Salah leaving, Munoz, I don't know loads about, but I'm pretty sure that was for the left anyway. Like that's another spot taken out there. I don't know what's going on with like Cody Gakpo. I think there's potential for him to be leaving Liverpool. There's certainly noises.
At the very
around.
Least, there'd be competition, right? Which he hasn't really had this season.
Yeah, and so what we need to see in Diamande is the productivity, like how consistent is it? Like, I love the way he gets at people. I love the directness. But then there's been loads of players that have come into the Premier League who have that, you know. Nicolas Pepe, I thought was going to be a good sign-in and didn't work out. So there's not... The problem I keep going back to with Diamande is there's not a huge body of work to look at. And that's what I struggle with a bit. Like, his rise out of US football into European football was so insanely quick. And don't get me wrong, like, he's raised the bar at every level he's played. And what I am impressed by is wherever you put him, he rises to the challenge and says, what's next? And that is a very, very difficult thing to do, especially when you're still as young as he is. And he's pushed. And now Leipzig, they're obviously going to get to a stage where they're going to have to become tempted soon to accept an offer. We haven't got there yet, but, and I know Leipzig would ideally keep him, but the player's head is now turned, right?
Yeah, I mean, also the other thing is what that impacts on someone like an Antonio Nusser, I think has been very good for Norway in spells at this World Cup as well. They're not going to sell both of their starting wingers, I assume. So it potentially puts Nusser's, you know, potential future elsewhere on ice as well. And that I think is interesting, but it does feel like he is going to be the one that gets the move this summer. And look, someone's going to get one of the most exciting talents in world football. How that translates elsewhere, as you say, like, he feels like he continues to raise the bar. And having read that Players Tribune piece that kind of I referenced on last week when we were talking about him, where he's like, I'm not really motivated by money or fame. I just want to be the best player in the world. It's a bit of a scary concept for anyone else because you're like, oh, okay, cool. Like, it's not about being the face of things. It's about actually just being there and getting there and proving his late sister right. That's a mentality that feels pretty frozen in ice. And that is something that's very special indeed. All right, we're going to take a little break then. We'll come back on the other side. We're going to talk through a couple more emerging names of interest who've stood out at this World Cup so far. Make sure you stick with us. Welcome back to Ranks FC, our third and final part. We're just going to talk through a couple of other players who have stood out at this World Cup so far and where their situations might be at. And Dean, I want to start with a Premier League player in the form of Dani Munoz from Crystal Palace, who's obviously lit the tournament up for Colombia, scored two goals, a goal in each of their games to help them along to a winning start. And I think that Munoz is someone that a lot of people have admired for a while, pretty much since he came into the Premier League with Crystal Palace. And there was a little bit of a question over whether he could play as a fullback rather than as a wingback. Now, Colombia's system is a little bit specialized in that they effectively allow him to just roam up and down that flank at will in a sort of Achraf Hakimi-esque role. But he is playing in a back four here. And I imagine the fact that he's still able to get into dangerous areas there, he's shown no real worries from a defensive perspective. if someone might look at this Palace side and say, okay, new manager, potentially do, you know, occasionally need to make a sale, don't want to lose Wharton this window. If people maybe have a nibble on a Daniel Munoz, not that I think he should necessarily leave for what it's worth, but I think that his stock is continuing to rise.
It is, but then it was also, it did falter a little bit across last season. So I don't know if we're just kind of back to where we originally were with him. And I'm not sure, I get the impression, to be honest, Palace might be tempted to set, if somebody was to go in for him, then I think Palace would probably just look to find a younger version of him, to be honest. They're obviously in a state of flux in the sense that everything's changing at Palace, but the intent and the ambition remains strong. And so I think this was proof to anyone that's watching him that he could still be a good signing. But I think for Palace, it might work out well, because I think by the end of last season, they were starting to wonder if those sorts of areas on the pitch is where they need to start finding upgrades.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I mean, look, I think he's been absolutely brilliant across most of his time at Palace. I think he's been brilliant at this World Cup. There were a few question marks over whether he leaves a little bit too much space in behind for a team that aren't utilising him as a wing back. But I think that they're kind of blown out of the water by what he brings from an attacking contribution. And we're seeing that again and again, you know, for club and for country. So we'll see. Another one that's been a little bit in the news is Maxi Araujo, who has been Uruguay's best player, who has been the kind of star man for them. He's got 2 goals and an assist of their 3 goals in this competition so far. He's played for Sporting as a left back for much of this campaign, but he's being utilised as a very attack-minded left back. Bielsa clearly sees him as a more forward-thinking player, has played him on the left wing, and he's been very good there. In a poor Uruguay side, he's been the standout player as far as I've been concerned. He was very, very good for Sporting last season. We saw a couple of excellent goals. We saw an incredible work rate up and down that flank. And there was a bit of a rumour before the World Cup that he was someone that the Manchester United might be interested in as they kind of try and move on in their left-back position. I have my concerns about this because I think that in many ways Araujo is quite similar to a Patrick Dorgu in that whilst he is nominally a left-back, you probably want him further up the pitch in order to actually get the best out of him. And if that's how you want to deploy your left-back, I'm not sure that United would need to bring in a player with such similar characteristics to a Dorgu.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I think it's pretty clear from conversations I've had that if United sign a left-back, then their dream candidate would be Lewis Hall. They'd considered Nathaniel Brown as somebody else that they would like. Patrick Dorgu, I think, will end up as a left-sided attacker for Man United under Carrick. Obviously, we'll still be able to play left back, but I don't think primarily that's where they want him to be playing. So, yeah, it would be kind of surprising. It's not one that I've heard as a prime position for him, but obviously the rumor is out there. The other thing is that like he's not going to be cheap, is he? And so that's something else to consider. Man United, while they have got a lot of money they're willing to spend, they do have a limit on position by position what they would actually do and how much trust they could put into the transfer. So that's why a lot of their transfer business, primarily they would prefer to be players that have done it already in the Premier League, just because the transition will be easier. A great player, absolutely no doubt about it. There will be transfer speculation, whether it's Man United or elsewhere. And yes, as you say, done himself no harm at all.
Yeah, 100%. A couple more then to kind of rattle through before we go. An honourable mention here, by the way, to Ismaël Koné, who obviously broke his leg in that incredibly sad tackle in the game against Qatar. He's had a brilliant season for Sassuolo. He's been key for Canada in the sort of 150-odd minutes or so we saw of him in this World Cup. I thought he was potentially on for a really big transfer this summer, maybe to, you know, a top Italian side to stay in Serie A, but I think there would have been plenty of interest, especially with his history sort of bouncing around in different leagues in Europe so far already in his career. Really, really, really sad for him, because I think that there could have been some really interesting options on the table for Ismaël Koné. So thoughts with him at what is obviously a very difficult time, but backing him to bounce back, a really interesting footballer, Ismaël Koné. Talking of cool central midfielders, the one that emerged in the Ivory Coast game against Germany was Christ Inao Olayi. Now, Patreon listeners will know that I was very hot on this kid before the World Cup started. I was really disappointed that we didn't see him him in that first Ivory Coast game against Ecuador. He plays for Trabzonspor, 20 years old, and effectively came up against a very, very talented, very good Germany midfield and bossed it. His ability to shield in possession, Dean, his ability to just move through pressure, get the attacking phases going, to transition, his explosiveness and dynamism in there. I absolutely adored this as a debut. And considering he is plying his trade in Turkey with Trabzonspor, not necessarily one of the big guns or the big payers in that league, I think that that gives us something interesting to work with. And I'll be very surprised if there isn't serious interest from the big five in this kid.
Yeah, this is definitely the sort of player that you suggest, mate, that puts him on my transfer radar as well. There have been links with Barcelona. I've seen. I haven't heard anything personally in terms of my transfer world. But as soon as you start putting these things to me around this time of year, I take them seriously, and we start to dig into where they end up, because they certainly do end up as real stories. But 50 million euros is what he's rated at. Does that seem fair?
I think it's a bit of a gamble, not in terms of his skill set. His skill set is obviously there, but obviously we've not seen that transition into necessarily a top league. I would probably be looking maybe 35, 40. I think you put that offer on the table, I think you might get a little bit of a nibble. So I think it's a good gamble to take. I think he has all of the skills to be an absolutely wonderful footballer for so many years to come. But I think that when we're kind of looking at it right now, there's still a few questions to answer in terms of where he's at and what the trajectory looks like. If I was a club in that kind of Europa League, maybe pushing Champions League range, I'd be putting a 35 odd million euro offer on the table and seeing what the appetite was and having that and opening that conversation. I think that's the kind of level I'd have him at right now.
Nice.
A couple more then. Caleb Urenki, who played very well against England yesterday for Ghana, was the hero in their first game against Panama, is Michael Essien's protege, now playing at Nordjylland, as many of the Ghanaian players who come through the Right to Dream Academy do. He's also a player that's a very, very exciting talent. Was used weirdly at right back by Otto Addo in this Ghana team before. That didn't really ever work out, but since he's moved into midfield, looks like the complete package. I think he is a kind of fun player to keep an eye on, because he's been effectively praised as someone who's capable of stepping up to the task every single time he's been given a new challenge, whether that be a club level, whether that be an international level. He's got enough kind of minutes in the legs now that I think that we have a body of work to examine from him. And I'm not 100% sure where this one goes, but I would be surprised if he's a Nordjylland player by the end of the summer, Dean.
Yeah, I'm not sure quite how high the transfer might be. But there'll be Champions League caliber clubs that I think would look at him based on what he's managing to achieve at the moment. He's a bit, unlike, when I've watched him in this World Cup, I'm really torn on him. Sometimes I think he's really nice, and sometimes he really irritates me. I don't know, maybe if he was on my team, I'd like him more. I don't know. Maybe he irritated me because he was against my team. I don't know. But
he kept winning the ball probably against England.
Yeah. He just felt a bit bitty. I don't know. He did. You're right. Like, he did. And that is something that rattled me. But I don't know. I don't know how high I would say his ceiling is. I think he's very good, but...
Feels like a transfer to Lons.
Exactly. Like... That's the sort of thing I'm saying.
Feels like a transfer to Lons, and then in 2 years' time, people are like, why didn't we just buy him when he was at Nordjylland? That's where I'm at.
Yeah, there will be a stepping stone club. Well, yeah, he won't like skip that step, I don't think.
No, I think you're right. I think it is maybe a move to France that kind of gives him the launch pad from which to work. But I think there's a plenty of talent there. And I do think that he is the kind of transfer. He's the kind of transfer that Brighton make. And everyone's like, what? And then in 2 years' time, he's absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, they'll loan him out for a year and then coming back.
Yeah, 100%. Just two slightly older players to finish off. Raul Rangel, 26 years old, the goalkeeper for Mexico, plays for Chivas Guadalajara. I know that Feyenoord have been tracking him for some time now. And they see him as a potential number one. his record for the Mexican national team is unbelievable. I think it's 8 clean sheets in his last 10 games for them. He's spoken about the facts, you know, according to reports, that his dream is to play in the Premier League. 6'3", very good command of his area. Someone who made, obviously, maybe the save of the tournament in that game against South Korea to guarantee Mexico's qualification and their top spot in the group. I thought it was intriguing in many ways, Dean, that he's spoken about this. I think there is a move. I don't think a Premier League side will naturally gamble on him right now, but I wouldn't be surprised to see him playing in Europe next summer.
Mate, there's a few goalkeepers. I obviously don't rate goalkeepers as footballers, but one thing I'm struggling with at the moment is how this is the World Cup of goalkeepers, mate. Like, we've seen some great displays, so I don't think he'll be the only one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anyone's going to gamble on Vuzinha at 40 years old. Like, I'd imagine he might still be knocking around at Shavs next season. But, like, it is what it is, right? Eloy Room, similar kind of story. Though obviously, he's a little bit younger. I don't think anyone's going to be signing kind of the old guard of goalkeepers. But I think there are a few interesting ones. Zion Suzuki, I really like. The Japanese goalkeeper who's been at Parma for a while. I think that there will be interest in him going forward. He's a really, really clever footballer. Really clever keeper with his feet as well. I think people will be interested in him. The last one I have, Dean, is maybe the most established name on this list. In Ayase Oeda from Japan and Feyenoord, he was the Eredivisie top scorer last season, 27 years old. He'll be 28 by the time that the next season begins. His birthday's in August. But I love Oeda just as a player. He is a complete all-round striker. You look at the two goals that he scores in that win over Tunisia, and yes, take it with a pinch of salt, it's Tunisia, but the first one, a strike from the edge of the box where he takes it down and just leathers it into the corner. The second one, a looping header. He beats two players on the line. He's really good in the air. He holds the ball up well. He can shoot with either foot. He gets into good spaces. His movement's excellent. Just a really nicely rounded footballer. And whilst he's slightly older than some of these others that we've discussed, I think that this is the moment. If he's going to get a move, it's going to be now. And it's going to be off the back of this tournament plus top scoring in the Eredivisie. And I wonder if a good tournament might be the difference here between, you know, there's often a little bit of reticence to go near the Eredivisie top scorer because you're like, yeah, we've had boom and bust in that, you know, obviously for every Luis Suarez, there's a Matija Kesman. But I wonder if there is a kind of world here where we look at Ayase Oeda having a good World Cup for the rest of it and then being in demand, maybe not from the top clubs, but I'd imagine with clubs with a little bit of money, maybe in that kind of middle pack.
Everton, Brighton, Leeds are the sorts of clubs that you're looking at being linked with him, mate. So I think that even Fulham, you know, at a time when you need a forward, you know,
I'm holding out hope that Fulham are going to sign Flo Balogun, but I think it's a forlorn hope.
Oh, I'd like that too, mate. I'd love that. And you'd like to think that if we were to have a chance of signing anyone, then some of the American links might finally be some benefit to it. But yeah, we'll see. But yeah, that's the sort of clubs being linked with him. And I think that seems about right.
Yeah, really nice footballer. I like Oeda a lot. And I think his career path, he's stepped up everywhere he's gone. Might be time. This might be the moment for him to get that step up. And with that, I think we're going to bring this podcast to a close.
More back. Football to watch, Jack. More football to watch.
We will be back once the group stages are over to maybe kind of put a bit more order into things and see where we have everyone pegged once we have that round of 32. But for the time being, what's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. We hope you've enjoyed this episode as ever. And we'll see you all very shortly, Rank Squad. Take it easy. Peace.